Sales. So, Vito Quaranta, I'm a professor of cancer biology. Sounds important at Vanderbilt University, Nashville, Tennessee. And let's see, I'm director of the Center for Cancer Systems Biology, actually CCSB, which is actually entirely funded by the NCI. And actually, we have, might as well go here, saving a slide. We have actually two sites. So we have one site at Vanderbilt, and then the other site is at Moffitt, at the IMO that was introduced yesterday by Bob Gatenby. And so Sandy Anderson and his group has been, has been our good collaborator for now, since 2004, as many, 8 years or so. And so I am a great advocate of the immense potential for dramatic progress through the interaction of mathematics and medicine. So, now you know who you're dealing with. So thank you, Phil, for making me embarrass myself. So thank you. All right, so like I said, so this is the CCSB, so we've been funded by the NCI, and as you can see, there is a kind of an eclectic, besides the mathematicians, we also have lots of computational people, biostatisticians, and we also run a fairly beefy, outreach and education program where we take in undergraduate students and sometimes even people in mid-career, like we're getting a mathematics teacher, from the Philippines, who's going to spend 6 months, at our site, just to recycle her thinking for better or worse. So today we're going to talk about single cells. And so yesterday I couldn't have done a better job in hopefully convincing it. At least he made the case for how important it is to study single cells in a disease such as cancer. And we're going to talk about drugs, okay, and the new generation of drugs that has been on the scene for about 10 years, kind of sort of works, is the great promise, and I'll tell you a bit more about that in a couple of minutes. Okay, so now before I go into the core of my talk, I would also like to give a little bit of background, what we've been doing, how we got to where we are, why we're doing what we're doing, and why we're taking the direction that we're taking. And so, and this is a good example of something that systems biologists talk about, the idea of going from theory to experimentation, back to theory, back to experimentation. So this interaction between modeling and experimentation, where modeling, so when you have a problem, and we've seen plenty of those examples, that drives modeling, and then based on the outcome of models, as everybody knows that all models are wrong, but many models are actually useful. And so when you run the models, so the outcomes, they give you ideas for experimentation. So now you have model-driven experimentation, and now these data can drive further modeling, and then you can go back, and so you go around this circle until you're satisfied and you have a realistic representation of a process, a complex process, generally. So I think we walked through this walk at least once. We're about to go back up, and we're excited about that. And so let me give you also our point of view. So of course we are a cancer systems biology group, and so this is I'm not going to go into the definition of systems biology, but this is the theoretical framework of systems biology. And some people actually yesterday talked about that. And so we view cancer progression really as a complex process. So complex, not complicated, complex. So with all the physical and mathematical, implications that means. And there's many interactive variables that you really have to juggle at one time, because you have to choose carefully. And then you can go after outcomes of interest, in this complex process. It could be uncontrolled growth, it could be invasion, it could be metabolism, metastasis, whatever you're interested in. And so how do we model this this process? So we started it out with a model that was devised by Sandy Anderson. And this is Sandy, as he's thinking about, mathematical greatness. Bob, make sure you tell him that I have this slide. He hasn't seen it yet. And so, oops, I don't know why I did that, but, oh, maybe I know. Yeah, I pushed too hard. So, so this is Sandy's original model. Again, so it's a model that is simple enough that can be handled, but not too simple so that it does not display any interacting dynamics. So there are some interacting dynamics that I'm going to show you in a second that actually prompted, you know, how we went on to do further experimentation. And so it's a hybrid model. There is a field that is defined by these partial differential equations. And then what he introduced is this agent-based a model, a cellular automaton that represents cells. So actually that is really palatable, you know, to biologists because, and I'll get back to this, because of this idea that a cancer population is heterogeneous, so each individual cell sort of has a mind of its own. And so this is the life of a cell in Sandy's model, in this cellular automaton, is represented here. So the cell can go through these iterations as it matures and divides again, ages and divides again. So you've got a lot of choice that you can do based on what's going on in the domain. And then when it divides, the two daughter cells actually have a certain rate of mutation that can be relative to traits like proliferation, cell adhesion, oxygen consumption, migration, ECM degradation, and so on. And so you can actually generate diversity in this model. And so when you do this and you run the simulation, so what you find is that, so like I anticipated, this is all published, so I'm just running through this. So the dynamics are kind of interesting. For example, you know, what you see is that, so remember, the domain, you can control the domain. So you can say how much extracellular matrix you have, how many proteases are made by cells, and actually the cells, as they proliferate, they can change, you know, the amount of proteases they make and how they migrate and they proliferate and so on. Okay, and so what happens is that as you change the conditions of the environment, you get different shapes of the tumor. And this is interesting. And now you can change the extracellular matrix composition. You may say, well, okay, so you introduce some hills, and therefore the cells go around these hills. But this also happens, this transition from what we would call perhaps a non-invasive to an invasive, you know, cancer. This is all in silico, remember that. So, but you can also do this when you, say, turn down the availability of nutrients. Okay, so what the way we interpret this is that under harsh conditions, you know, that the shape of the tumor changes. What's even more interesting is that, remember, the model is producing phenotypes. Okay, it's changing the mutation rate. And so what happens as you move to very harsh or harsher conditions, the number of phenotypes narrows. And so you end up generally with 1 to 3 phenotypes, whereas here you can have as many as 10, 20 that survive together. So now this is interesting because now this is telling us that, you know, maybe there are selective forces that actually drive the final makeup of the tumor in terms of what phenotypes, you know, are going to be present in the end. And of course, these phenotypes are the fittest, you know, to the environment. So I don't have to go through all of these implications. You know, yesterday a lot of people talked about you know, selective forces and how the tumor may adapt. And so just to be clear, so in my mind, the adaptability, this is the definition that I found, you know, most suitable, the ability of a system to continue to function in the face of an uncertain or an unknown environment. So remember, adaptability, so is to think about it as an intrinsic property of a cell, not necessarily a cancer cell, but any cell. Okay, and so once we saw how this heterogeneity of the tumor was being defined, so it became clear to me, so we're in 2004, 2005, so immediately, you know, a thought popped up, and that is tumor heterogeneity. And, you know, I entered actually the cancer field about 1978. And there was this idea at the time, you know, this guy, Josh Fidler, was making a name for himself. He's still active in the field at MD Anderson. And he made just to give you a sense for how ideas, you know, that seem obvious today, but not so obvious only, you know, 40 years ago or so. And so he actually made a name for himself by publishing this paper and saying that tumors are heterogeneous. The idea had been around for a while, but he was able to push it and actually make some measurements, which is generally, you know, what switches, you know, people more, you know, makes it acceptable to other people. So yes, he had developed this B16 melanoma model, which is still available and people still use. It's one of the best models, you know, to study heterogeneity. And we've actually been inspired by some of the experiments that he did and something that we'll show a little bit later. So for 30, 40 years, people have been talking about heterogeneity of tumors. But again, what is really heterogeneity? What can we do? So the word heterogeneity or thinking about heterogeneity can be disempowering if you can't handle it. Okay, it's like something that you cannot deal with. But the way, you know, to address it and now to instead, you know, turn it into an enabling thought is to, or an enabling point of view, is to actually start quantifying it. And so, having seen what we had seen in Sandy's model, so we set out to ask the question, okay, how do we quantify tumor heterogeneity? And if we can do that, how can we then quantify the consequences on population dynamics, for example, population level adaptability in the face of changes in the microenvironment, including drugs and so on. Now, as I start to look into heterogeneity and things like that, you know, there's people that work on this actually actively. I was immediately said that to say heterogeneity means very little, and I sort of was saying that yesterday. You always have to say heterogeneity should be measured with respect to something. So in this room, there's people are different from each other, but, you know, we really haven't said anything. I mean, we knew that. But, you know, you can make a difference. Say, for instance, how many people wear glasses. So you can have heterogeneity with respect to wearing glasses, heterogeneity with, you know, with respect to wearing badges, you know, or striped shirts, you know, and so on and so forth. So now you start introducing some measurable, some metrics, so something that you can measure. And so this now inspires our current approach. And when we looked around, so this took us a while to figure out, you know, how do we measure tumor heterogeneity? Which kind of metric can we actually use that is useful, that is going to make us go a bit faster, and especially in publishing papers? And so the choice that we made, you know, about 3-4 years ago is to start defining cancer heterogeneity with respect to their response to targeted therapeutics. And then I'm going to spend a couple of slides, you know, talking about this. I was actually a little bit surprised that yesterday, you know, we really didn't talk much because, to my mind, the development of targeted therapeutics has been one of the key changes in cancer biology, and actually in the whole field of cancer research in the last 10 years or so. And actually, Time Magazine and many other publications, the New York Times and so on, you know, picked up on this. Wall Street picked up on this. Investors picked up on this. And this is, I think, this is 2004. Just to give you a sense that this is not something that has been around for a long time. And what targeted therapeutics are, they are produced by chemical biologists, by pharmaceutical companies, and they're pills. So compare this with radiation therapy and basically the poisonous, you know, chemotherapy that people do. So the idea is that you can now control, or perhaps in some cases, you know, get rid of cancer disease, you know, with a pill, with some side effects, but nothing compared to the side effects that people go through after radiation or chemotherapy and so on. And so it's a revolution. And so these are the bullets. I don't necessarily agree with the word bullets, you know, but, you know, it's just a way to state that actually there is a revolution going on. Or the potential for a revolution. And keep in mind that revolutions, they sort of happen quickly, but then the consequences develop over a number of many, 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 many years. To give you a sense, penicillin, the observation of Fleming to the deployment took about, I think, 20 or 30 years, and somebody else had to come in, this guy Florey, and the World War II and the military had to come in to push for production. So it takes a while for things to be actually implemented. Things go faster, you know, these days, but let's keep that in mind, that things are not like, you know, don't happen, you know, instantaneously. And one reason why they don't happen instantaneously is because, you know, there is an initial period of excitement, but in the case of cancer, of the targeted therapeutics, you know, there's many challenges, you know, that remain. This were talked about yesterday by a few of the speakers. You know, there are unexplained failures. There are also a phenomenon of resistance. And actually, I think I'm missing a slide here. Let me see. Yeah, I'm missing a slide. Okay, and I'll tell you what the... So there is one thing that should be clear. So what are targeted therapeutics? So I'm just realizing that I'm not talking to an entire biological audience. So what targeted therapeutics are small molecules that are produced to specifically interfere with a mutation in a molecule that drives the process of cancer. Okay, so for example, the EGF receptor, mutation in the receptor for epidermal growth factor, drives about 5% of lung cancers. Okay, and so there are molecules that are specifically made to interfere with that specific mutation, which is a mutation that modifies the affinity for ATP in the EGFR. Okay, and so there are other cancers, for instance, and actually I have a kind of a slide in a minute. So the one of the issues that we found as we started to approach this field is the cellular responses, while the molecular responses to targeted therapies are very well characterized. And so, for example, the affinity for a given molecule to its target molecule, EGF receptor or BRAF or other members of the EGF receptor family, are very well characterized. We know just about anything we can. We can model molecular, we can generate molecular models how they dock, you know, with each other. The cellular response is not as well characterized for a number of reasons, not the last one being that there aren't very good assays. For example, the standard assay to characterize targeted therapeutics, and we'll talk about this in a minute, is an assay in which you compare the growth of a control with the growth of a cell control with the growth of the same cell in the presence of the targeted therapeutic. And so all you're doing, you're just saying that in the presence of the targeted therapeutic, a cell grows at a slower rate as opposed to the other one, but you don't know why it is growing at a slower rate. In fact, you don't even know that it's growing at a slower rate, and people assume that these targeted therapeutics actually kill cells, and I'm going to show that it is not correct, or at least, you know, it's a stretch. So we've been examining cell behavioral responses to TT, and there's a number of questions that you can ask. I think I'm going to go through this very quickly, but just to give you a sense, you know, how young, you know, this field still is. So like I mentioned, the cell population response to TT, does it evolve in time, or is it like a sort of a fixed thing that doesn't change? How does the response of single cells shape the population response? So remember, we're still dealing with a tumor population that we know is heterogeneous, and so how does that play a role into the way the population responds? What are the rates, and how do responses differ in resistant versus non-resistant cells, and what is the molecular basis for the response, and how can we exploit, you know, this knowledge to make targeted therapeutics work or targeted therapy work a little bit better? And so I'm going to give you... Oops. Okay. I'm going to give you just an overview of the results that we have obtained in the laboratory, but I will focus mostly on this, in fact, almost exclusively on this. So right now, in the world of targeted therapy, okay, even though there is a lot of excitement, you know, for this, there are really three cancer types that respond, and it's about 5% of all adenocarcinomas of the lung. You experience tumor shrinkage with this drug, erlotinib, or similar drugs like gefitinib that address the molecular mutations in this, which is EGFR mutation. BRAF mutating melanoma, this drug, you know, PLX4720, made by Roche, Plexxikon. These are, by the way, these are blockbuster drugs. This, I think, sells about 10 billion B with a B a year. This, I'm not sure how much. This one sells. This came out about 3 years ago. Give you a sense, there is absolutely nothing you can do for melanoma. The PLX drugs started to show these dramatic responses. I'll get to that, you know, in a little bit. And there is somewhat of increased survival. And it targets a mutation, BRAF. This is a signaling molecule, also in the EGF pathway, that is present in about 40% of all melanomas. And 70% of that 40% responds positively to PLX. So this is exciting if you are a clinical oncologist. And then lapatinib is a drug that's used in HER2-overexpressed, you know, breast cancer, which is about, I think, maybe between 10 and 15%. I may have these numbers a little bit wrong. But again, this was a deadly disease, no longer, because of lapatinib. There's also an antibody, Herceptin, maybe you heard about that. Herceptin, for instance, also sells about, you know, 8 to 9 billion a year. This is basically what we see, okay? And let me give you the punchline to this. The current view, and I'll show you an X-ray a little bit later, or an MRI a little bit later. The current view is that targeted therapeutics, you know, kill cancer cells, so they take them out. In reality, what I'm going to show you is that the response these tumors that are called oncogene addicted, because there is one particular mutation in one oncogene, in this case BRAF, mutated EGFR or HER2 overexpressed. So the response of these cells to targeted therapeutics is really a complex mix, and actually a complex temporal mix. So there's some dynamics that need to be characterized. And the response is a mix of death, quiescence, and division. And in fact, death is not even the major response. In some, you know, you can get to 50% in these cases, but in this, in melanoma and HER2 overexpressing breast cancer, the death response stays at 5 to 6%. So which raises the question: why do these things work, and why were they approved by the FDA? And I think we're going to go through that. And is actually in the end the. I think my view, I can anticipate this to you, is that I'm optimistic about this as long as we are quantitative, you know, about understanding what these things do. And I'm going to show you now mostly the work of several people, okay, but Darren Tyson. I'm going to talk mostly about the EGFR continuum. So Darren Tyson, in our group, he set up a basic technique to actually follow the response of cells to erlotinib at the single cell level, okay? And so what we do, I'm not going to go through details, but I'm happy to talk to you later about it. So we use automated microscopes. So this is a generation of microscopes that's been still in development, and in the last 10 years they've become eminently usable. And so the lens, the objective moves, or the plate moves. And so these are, for those of you that have not been in a lab, this is a 96-well plate. So you can have about 60 usable wells, and each one of these wells contains hundreds to thousands of cells. And with this kind of microscope, you can actually take a picture every 6 minutes, or even depending on some technical problems, you know, with the cells, the phototoxicity, you can even go at a higher, you usually go between 6 and 10 minutes. And so essentially what you do, you generate a movie. Okay, so you have over, say, a period of 3 to 10 days, you actually know, or you are in a position to actually know what happens to every single cell in all of these wells. And so, for instance, in this experiment, we're looking at the response of PC9 cells. So PC9 is a lung carcinoma cell line that contains the mutation that makes it addicted to erlotinib. Okay, so it's a model for human cancer, adenocarcinoma of the lung that contains mutations. So PC9 contains exactly the same mutations. Came out of a Japanese patient, you know, 30 years ago or so. And this is an experiment where PC9 has been challenged with increasing concentrations of erlotinib, which is a targeted therapeutic. Gefitinib would be the same. And it goes from 1 nanomolar to 4 micromolar. The clinical usable dose is about 2 to 4 micromolar. Okay, so you can see also this is over a period of several days. Just to give you a sense, this is the control. You can see how cells grow here exponentially. But then, as you increase the dose, you can see less and less cells. But the difference between this and this is not that much. We're still at 24 hours here, but so this difference will increase. But again, the point is that there are still some cells left. And so once we saw these things, we got into it to characterize it in a little bit more in detail. And so one of the things that you can do with these automated microscopes, you know, is a very simple thing, which is may sound obvious, but you can actually count cells directly. So, you know, cells are little guys, and so in order to count them, you have to sit at the microscope, you know, and count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So this is not usually done. Okay, in fact, over the last, so when I started in the lab, I used to count cells manually, but you can only do it maybe every 12 hours if you are diligent and devoted. People usually do it every 24 hours, and people don't use a microscope anymore, so they don't look at cells anymore. There are surrogate assays. And surrogate assays are just such, you know, they're surrogates. And so people look, for instance, at the concentration of an enzyme, the concentration of the DNA, so we don't look at cells anymore. But now the microscope, the automated microscope, give us the ability to look at cells every 6 minutes, okay? And so this is good, because we're actually counting cells directly. And now there is another problem, that people don't want to look at image stacks, because you still get a movie, but then you got to count them, okay? It's easier. You don't have to sit at the microscope. You can do it at your own leisure. You can have undergraduates, like we do, actually, do this, you know, at $8 an hour, and they love it, you know, because they make money, and they can be sitting at Starbucks, you know, whatever. You know, but you know, better yet, you can use image processing, which is trickier than they were originally thought. You know, we actually bargained, we got more than we bargained for, especially when images. But you know, I think we're at a point where we can now segment these images and actually count cells very accurately. And so what I show here now, these are actual counts. Actually, I'm not even showing all of the results. So we count cells every 6 minutes, okay? But we're showing here only, this is real data. This is not a fit. This is real data every hour, okay? And so one thing that we can say is that, yes, these cells are actually growing exponentially. This is in sync. And then see, as the cells become now, so the carrying capacity kicks in, you know, so you can see that this thing now becomes nonlinear here. This is, I believe this is a log scale. I think it's log base 2. So good. So cells grow exponentially, which is nice. And and then we have also a way to count these cells, which is accurate. So enter erlotinib. Now we throw in erlotinib, and so remember the idea is that erlotinib kills cells. And so this is now what we see. And so there's a couple of points I'd like to make from here. So notice again, this is a log base 2 scale, okay? So if cells are growing exponentially, then this should be a straight line, which it is in the beginning, okay? And then if something like, you know, death comes in, or so if the division rate actually changes, then the slope of this should change. What you should find, I mean, I don't have to teach you this, you know, this should move. Actually, I have a slide a little bit later. And in fact, what we saw is that there is this response that is actually eminently nonlinear. It's reminiscent of the response you get in control when cells become crowded. Another thing also is that it kind of gets mixed up here, where, say, for instance, this line is actually four lines together from 62 nanomolar to 4,000 nanomolar. So this is really strange, okay? And of course, you can imagine, we've done this experiment many, 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 many times, okay? And this is the way it works, so we know. And so compare this with the industry standard. So the industry standard to actually evaluate the effect of erlotinib on PC9 cells. And so this is used by pharmaceutical companies, biochemists. So this is the way it's done, okay? So growth inhibition 50. So is the concentration of the drug that inhibits the number of cells measured with a surrogate assay, okay, at 50%, okay, with respect to control. And so from this kind of assay, all we can say, so first of all, it's an endpoint assay, 72 hours, period. So there are no dynamics in time, as you can see here, okay? And for instance, you can see here that the response at 72 hours, you can make some judgment, 48 hours, 24 hours, 96, and go on. I'll show you data 10 days. And then the other thing is that you actually have no idea what's going on. Okay, all you can say is that cells, there is a lower number of cells, okay, as measured by the surrogate assay, and you don't know why. You don't know why. And people assume, well, there is a lower number of cells because they're dead. They're dead. Okay, and I basically already said this. Okay, so one conclusion is that I want to make here is that, so in tumors, now remember, we saw a lot of structures yesterday showing a lot of pictures of tumors. So the response to targeted therapeutics may be immediately highly heterogeneous, even because of the way the drug is distributing the tumor. And so 15 nanomolar versus 4,000 nanomolar gave different effects, you know, at different times. If you look at 96 hours, they basically do the same thing. If you look at 24 hours, maybe not. And that's just a fancy, or not so fancy way, of depicting the fact that we have nonlinearity both with respect to time here and with respect to concentration. So it's really something that deserves, you know, to be looked at in more detail. And so uneven drug distribution could produce highly variable responses, and so it is unlikely that by that you are going to deliver a clean hit. And so there's going to be a spectrum of induced behaviors. Okay, so having this now, we wanted to have some kind of a model to it. So of course, you know, what people do, they use either the logistic curve or better yet, you know, a fit, you know, with the Gompers equation, you know, for this kind of exponential growth that then level off for whatever reason. And the idea is there is a carrying capacity, you know, and so on. Now, when we started to look at the microscope, we realized that we really, you know, if we went with the idea of the Gompers, the carrying capacity, we really had no biological equivalent of the carrying capacity. So what do we do with that? So we have this number, K, I believe it's called, and so, but how do we, because that's the power of modeling. You know, if I have some kind of a parameter that in some way I can link to some kind of biological, or better yet, you know, biochemical event. And in fact, even when you look, when you apply, you know, Gompers dynamics, you know, to the Earth population, you know, you don't really know, you know, what's carrying capacity? Where is it coming from? Maybe we have some better idea there, but still. In this case, we're given a drug. And so we felt that we needed to have a better fit. And so what we noticed is that essentially we need to take three things into consideration. And this is no big mathematics, okay? This is just, you know, simple stuff. It's just, you know, statistical, basically a way to do some statistical fits. And so Schongerbeck, you know, came up with this idea that, okay, if we see cells that proliferate, that divide, cells that die, and cells that become quiescent, okay, they stop dividing, but they don't die, okay, that's what we're observing, then maybe we can have a model in which we have these rates of transition from dividing to quiescent, or from dividing to dead, from quiescent to dead, and of course the dividing cells, they replenish themselves. And so we did this, and this is the formula. And so that's interesting because, so like I was saying before, division or death would only affect the slope, but now with the quiescence term, okay, we can actually get these nonlinear curves, and now we can start fitting these data. And so this is not published yet, but so we are, we have a pretty good fit. I'm not going to go through that, but let me tell you, the fit, you know, is quite good. But the bottom line is, okay, so all we've done, we've made some, you know, statistical model that fits the data, so what? Is actually this nonlinear behavior, you know, due to the fact that cells enter quiescence? And so now we're no longer counting cells, now we're looking at the behavior of individual cells. Okay, so now we're going to be tracking cells, that's where we start to run into problems, because we're going to track cells. The microscope that we have came with its own tracking algorithm. It was no good. There's a lot of commercially available algorithms that are also not very good for what we want to do. And just let me tell you this, you know, at the end of the day, this fellow, the student in our lab, the bioengineering student, Walter Georgescu, decided to just go on his experience in coding, because he made a MATLAB based algorithm called cell animation, which is now published. And so basically the reason why the algorithms that are out there don't work is because they're all based on particle tracking. But cells are a special kind of particle, they divide. And so we had to take this into account, and so be able, whenever a cell divides, you have to assign, so as far as the computer is or the image processing and tracking algorithm is concerned, there is something that's popping out from nowhere, right? So, but you have to keep track of the fact that that cell became two cells, and so you have to keep track of the progeny. That's not simple, especially in a crowded situation such as this one. And, you know, Walter, through several iterations, you know, was able to develop this cell animation, which is now published in Oxford Bioinformatics. And actually, I invite you, if you have any problems of this kind, please try and use this. It's open source, it's free, and Walter is actually going for a postdoc in the Bay Area, but is always very open, you know, to collaborations and helping you. This is a modular structure, so you can use different modules, mix them up, you know, for your own usages. And if you contact Walter, he will tell you no immediately, but if you ask him again, then he'll do it. And he's that the kind of guy, he's kind of protective, you know, of his own time. So S twice. Okay, and so now we have something, and now we can actually track cells individually. Okay, and so this is what happens. Okay, so essentially what we're doing is this. So we're looking here, for example, we're tracking how cells divide. So what we want to do, okay, what we're doing is we're tracking a population of dividing cells, and we want to know how long does it take from a cell that is just divide, okay, to divide again. Now remember, when cells divide, they kind of vanish. So there is a cell that divides. Now you have two daughter cells. And so the individual is gone, but you have two daughter cells. And so what you want to do, essentially, you're tracking some kind of a progeny. And so there are a number of questions that you can say. For example, if the mother cell divided after 10 hours, would the daughter cell divide also after 10 hours or not? And so you have this kind of variability that now could be built into the system. And so this is what we see. So these are with following cells at the birth time, so from the initial application of the drug. So the cell is born, say, after 5 hours, okay, and then it will divide again after so many hours, say, up here, for example. Okay, and so you can see there is quite a range. I'll show you the data in a second. Okay, a cell that is born, say, at this time, okay, and we know that it's 10 hours because we start tracking from the time that it had divided. Okay, so we know it's lived for 10 hours. Then it will divide over this big range. Okay, now if it reaches the end of experiment, okay, then there is no second mitotic event of cells. So we can say, we cannot say much about these cells, although we can make a probabilistic call on whether or not they will re-enter mitosis. And so this is now what the data looks like. This was really interesting, okay, because what we found is that, so the distribution, so now what we're looking at, remember, we're looking at how a cell population will divide, but because we're following single cells, we don't have a single number that says this population divides every 12 hours or 24 hours or 36 hours. Now, we don't have a single number, we have a distribution, which is interesting. So when it starts to make some insight into, you know, potential heterogeneity, what was really interesting, what really got us into this, is that this distribution, even in normal cells, is not normal. Okay, so it's not normal. So in other words, when you go around, you know, along this axis, okay, you don't find that cells go around some kind of a normal, which would say, okay, so this is some kind of a noisy biological process. But there is a distribution that tends to have a long tail. And as you know, tails, long tails, fat tails, you know, become kind of important. And these are big numbers, by the way. It's 120, but we can go up to the 1,000. So these distributions really hold. And so what we found, actually, is that we needed to fit this again. Okay, and so, again, Sean Garbett, you know, he went through various ways, you know, of fitting curves. And so in the end, I'm not going to go through this, you know, tried gamma distributions, you know, and kind of things. So in the end, the one that was most satisfying was because it has the least number of parameters, 3 parameters, is this exponentially modified Gaussian. Okay, and there's a number of reasons why this. Oh, here are the things that he did, you know, with the fit. And actually, Golubev published while we were doing this in 2010, published a paper saying that he looked at a bunch of data in the literature available over the last 10 years or so on single cell intermitotic times, and also came up with this fitting with this EMG. One of the nice things that I don't quite understand, but I think it's important, is that the exponential component and the Gaussian component can be split mathematically. And so it's interesting because now you may start thinking about this, again, this empowering part of the model, is that maybe there are two biochemical processes here. One that is perhaps a noisy process, you know, that gives you this Gaussian, and then maybe there is like a rolling dice kind of process that gives you the exponential. And actually, we're looking into that, and there are some interesting things I can go into maybe later. Okay, so now what we're going to do now, we're going to take the data, and so remember, we have the model I showed you before, the quiescent growth model, and then we have this EMG fit for single cells. The quiescent growth model is just based on counting cells. We make some predictions. We fit the data based on those 3 parameters, death, quiescence, or change in division rate in response to drug. So once we do this, then all we have is a fit, and now we want to validate, you know, this with single cell data that are fit, you know, with the EMG. And I don't want to go into details, you know, over this, but I can. So the reason why we need to do that is because we need to make a call on quiescence. And so what quiescence means is that the cell has been taken out of the cell cycle. It will no longer divide. And our experiments are limited in time. So we can only make a probabilistic call, you know, on whether or not the cell is quiescent. And, you know, we can talk about that. I don't know how well I can answer, but this will hopefully publish pretty soon. Okay, and so what do these things look like now? Okay, and so this is basically, so like I said, the population response to erlotinib. This is real data, not fit data. Again, just to reiterate, the single cell responses that we measure, we set them into these distributions, you know, of intermitotic time, so distributions, non-Gaussian. And so you can see that as you go from control to 15, so 3 nanomolar, 15 nanomolar, what you get is the band is increasing here. Note also the delayed response that stays the same. The drug was at the time zero. So there is a 24 to 30 hour delay in the response to erlotinib. Also notice, cells are still dividing, you know, at 25. So this indicates cells are dividing. If you go on in time, then you see that cells, there are some cells that collect here. If you compare this to this, you see that the tail is lengthening, and of course the Gaussian, the height, you know, is coming down. And so this is just to summarize, you know, all the results. Let me see. Yeah. And so basically, what we can do now, we can actually say something, okay, about what this response, which is based on counting cells, is made out of. Okay, and so as we move in time, we can make calls, you know, at each time. And so at 4 nanomolar, but about 4 nanomolar, okay, so we have the population of blue cells is a dividing population. And so, of course, it dominates here. At about 20 hours, we have this inflection point, and then it starts going down. Okay, so the dividing cells, but they're still there. They're still there. And then the population of quiescent cells, so these are cells that exit the cell cycle. They sit there, they don't die. The population is increasing. And as you go up at 15 nanomolar, then what you see here is that this curve is much more marked. And it goes down. And this one also, so what's happening here is that some of these cells and some of these cells, you know, are actually dying. Okay? And so you can make all of these things. I hope I have another slide. Yeah, so the quiescence rate increased about 50-fold, the death rate increased about 3-fold. And the division rate decreased by about 25%. So when we go to very high concentrations, such as the clinical concentration of erlotinib, the death rate does not surpass 10-fold increase. And so what is interesting here is that this matches the literature. But what the literature could not have told you is that the death rate goes up 10-fold, sometimes 20-fold, but there is still a substantial population of cells that is still dividing or is sitting there doing nothing or doing something that we don't know what it is. Okay, so what have you learned, as we learned so far? Okay, so what we've learned, and I'm coming to the end quickly here. So the PC9, this is a model for lung cancer. So it's oncogene addicted. Cell population responds to the tyrosine kinase inhibitor erlotinib. So it's a composite of single cell heterogeneous responses. So some cells die, some enter quiescent, some continue dividing. So why is this important? So why are we bothering with all this? Well, this is the reason why. And that is that this William Powell is a colleague at Vanderbilt. He's helping us tremendously with all this work. And he was a strong cadreing. And that's when he made the observation, one of these observations that set this field on fire, again, 2004. This is a tumor, this white stuff, in the lung of a patient that was treated with erlotinib or gefitinib in one of the two. And then 5 days later, the tumor was gone. Okay? So the observation, year 2000. And so this, of course, this is interpreted. So something has happened in the literature, okay, in the mind of people. And that is, because there is this disappearance in about 5 days, people thought the tumor is getting killed. So therefore, the effect of death in the effect of the erlotinib in vitro were also thought to be death. So So by analogy with clinical responses, it's assumed that the main response is this massive apoptosis. But I hope I convinced you, you know, that what we find is, in fact, the response is not so simple. And so perhaps we need to rethink the simple-minded, I should say, explanation that is massive apoptosis. Perhaps the drug response heterogeneity needs to be understood in depth. And so now to go back, you know, full circle, remember, so the Sandys model predicted that the heterogeneity is the base for adaptability. In the case of drug response, this is equivalent to saying that some of the cells will become resistant. That's, in fact, this is what is observed. You know, those tumors, even the tumors that have a spectacular response, within 6 to 12 months, they're back. So people live longer, but they still die. So by no stretch of the imagination, these targeted therapeutics, the way we use them today, cure cancer. And if I have, maybe I very quick, I'm running this thing, right? So very quickly, I'm gonna very quickly, I will not abuse it though. So very quickly, actually I think we're missing one speaker this morning, right? At the end, so we can make up for time, so lunch is okay. So, okay, and so having said that PC9 cells are heterogeneous, the PC9 cell line is heterogeneous, then we want to go to the next step, and so understand a little bit better. So we like to do some biochemistry now, okay, because, you know, cell biology is fine, you know, but now you want to understand what's going on. We're still not there, okay, but we made one significant step when a student in the lab, I think I should have a picture in it, maybe, yeah, in the next slide, Peter Frick, so a student, a talented student, he has a degree in physics, but when he came to the lab, he just started to run the pipette. I think he's the best experimentalist we have, and now his graduate school committee is telling him, hey, what about modeling? You know, you're doing too much experimentation, and that's okay. So what he did is this. So he said, okay, if the untreated parental population is heterogeneous, then he said, I should be able to clone out cells out of this population that have different behavior. Okay, because remember, some cells die, some cells survive, some cells quiesce. So if he had asked me, shall I do this experiment? I said, you know, forget about it. It's never going to work because, you know, so usually the way we think about it is that there are rare variants that do this thing. But, you know, he was looking at the data. The data are saying that these are not rare variants. You know, it's like 20% die, 30% keep dividing, you know, 70% or whatever it is, you know, 50%. Stop dividing. So he went ahead and just cloned out this population from single cells. And sure enough, you know, what he found is that each one of these, by the criterion of the GI50, remember the GI50, you measure growth in the press over lotinib compared to a control. By this criterion, they're not different from each other. Okay, so if we were to use the GI50, we would have to say that these clones, as well as perhaps the parental population, they don't have a heterogeneous response. However, When he started to look at these clones, you know, by live cell imaging, now he started to track dynamically, you know, the response to erlotinib. And what he did, he also introduced this neat little gadget here. You can introduce these genes in cells, just to give you a taste, you know, what we can do, okay, these days experimentally, perhaps too much. And so what this is a protein that is related to the cell cycle, okay? And so this protein has been engineered in such a way that when the cells are sitting there doing nothing, the protein is not even being produced, or it's produced and it's degraded very quickly. But when the cells divide, this protein stays on. So from the time they start making, duplicating the DNA, synthesizing DNA, all the way to the time they divide. And so when this cell, when this protein is made, it's called germinin for the aficionados, okay? This protein has been engineered in such a way that it's going to be fluorescent. And so, as a result, the cells that sit there are red. When they start dividing, they flash green. And then, once they divide, they're red again, which is called Fuchi. It's kind of an ingenious Japanese group, you know, that did this. So this is nice, because then you can see the cells, you know, when they divide, they're going to flash green. And this is nice now, because... So now you have another dimension. You can see in this population of cells, so you can see every time a cell divides, so boom, then it becomes red, and then if it divides again, it becomes green and so on. And so now you can have very accurate counts also of cells, you know, as they're dividing. And so now he's looking at three different clones that came out of the population. You can already see, I mean, just if you look at this, look at the time, they're all synced. You can see the difference by eye, okay? So you can see a clone one pretty soon within, say, 60 hours. There's no cells dividing. But look at the green cell, the cells flashing green here and there. Okay, and then you can, of course, quantify this. You can have responses in the presence of erlotinib. And you can see the differences. And this is with no, this is the control with no TKI. And so there is a heterogeneity that we can pick out. And so now this is powerful, and this is just another way of looking at it. So this is clone one, this is too extreme. And we also measure, you know, the single cell, so you're still working on counting these things. But you can see 49% are resting G1, 43% die, 72% pass the G1S. That means they enter, they become, they flash green. Okay? And then, and look inside the clone 7, only 12% die. I think the one before, I think it was 47%. Yeah, 43% to 12%. So big difference. Okay, and then you know, so many are resting G1, and there's almost 50% that keep passing, and this is, I think, between, I think between 3 and 5 days. And remember, 3 days is when we do the standard GI50 assay. Okay, so we're still working on these things. This is kind of a summary of the data, so you can see then. So the conclusion from this is that the heterogeneity with respect to the response to erlotinib actually pre-exists, is an intrinsic property of the PC9 population of cells, the parental population. Now, we can't say much about what it is. Now, we're doing the biochemistry now. But, you know, these are not rare variants, okay? So what that means is that the population is intrinsically heterogeneous for whatever reason. It could be genetic heterogeneity. It could be non-genetic heterogeneity. Different cells may have different capabilities, you know, of adapting to the drugs and so on. So we can discuss about that. And so the conclusion then on PC9 is that what I just told you, differential sensitivity to erlotinib, is apparent in long-term but not in in short-term endpoint assays such as GGI50. Is each clone, of course, each clone that you saw, I forgot to make that point, each clone also responds with this characteristic nonlinear curve, which means it's also heterogeneous with respect to erlotinib. So we're going, you know, so there is quantitative information now that we're collecting intraclonal and interclonal. And finally, the overall conclusion then is that we feel positive about treating oncogene addicted tumors, you know, with molecular targeted therapeutics, but death may occur over time, meaning death of the cells, okay? Variable rates, division may continue at appreciable levels, quiescence may be a major outcome. And I think this is really worthy of attention because we really cannot say much. You know, quiescent cells have not been studied that much in cell biology. We don't really know what that means. Does quiescent mean they're doing nothing? Or does it mean they've become some kind of a laboratory to do stuff that we don't quite understand? And so this heterogeneous drug response may be one of the routes for TT, and we should really say long-term failures, to the extent that adaptability of the cell relies upon single cell heterogeneity. I think this is it. Yeah. Okay? So thanks so much. Do we have So I have a question there.
It's very interesting because in our lab we also measure very similar things. So we found it's actually this is very important. You have clone, different clone have different growth rates, but have you ever also paid attention